You like the Star Wars? Well, of course you do, or you wouldn't have tuned in.
We do, we do. In fact, as moviegoers, when it comes to loving Star Wars, we either do or do not. There is no, well, it's okay, I guess.
That's a... There is do or do not. There is no...
But we do. We definitely do. And this episode will definitely reflect how much we actually do love the Star Wars.
Yes. In fact, this is the counterpoint, the promised counterpoint to the last episode, where we, as best we could, bash Star Wars. We talked about all things bad. We had our force fails. But, you know, if you listen to that episode, you know it was very difficult at times for us to really... engage in a fault-finding tour.
Yeah, for every pile of Bantha poodoo we came across, there was definitely a mountain of much better stuff to talk about.
Yeah, so it's little wonder we're following that with this. So we're going to talk about, as much as we can, and we'll likely have to follow up on this sometime, where Star Wars went right, and where does one begin? I guess the best point, best starting point, is at the beginning.
Okay.
Literally the, you know, one of the things that most people cite when they talk about how did you get hooked, and it's that opening sequence with the Star Destroyer chasing Leia's ship. You can't, it's just like, boom, you're in.
Mm-hmm.
But I may have talked about this before. Is that, you know, what really always to me was the linchpin of where everything went right was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah.
Because it puts it away from where you're comfortably normally seeing science fiction happen. And it makes the futuristic, in context, the past.
Exactly.
And that is just genius. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people tend to forget.
Mm-hmm.
That this isn't meant to be a future. This is meant to be a past for those who are living in the moments that are chronicled.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a good point. That's one of the things that, of course, I was so young anyway when Star Wars first came out. I think I was four.
You were just
five.
A baby.
Yeah, yeah, and I've said before on this show that Star Wars, I believe, was my very first movie experience. So what better way to kick off that, you know, than to see the Star Destroyer flying overhead. But more, you know, more of an impact on me was seeing Darth Vader and the Stormtroopers pile into the blockade runner and, you know, start to tear up the place. But,
Really, it does start out just, it's like wham, wham, wham. I mean, you're just being given this universe.
Mm-hmm.
In pretty swift punches one after another. So you better buckle up and get involved because, you know, this isn't going to be a simple thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to have it all fed to you. You're going to have to figure it out on your own, buddy.
That's right. That's right. And it's a good point. It wasn't what people were used to before. It wasn't that sterile, futuristic environment with people walking around and matching uniforms. I'll have to pick on Logan's Run for a second. And I hate to because Colleen, it's one of her favorite sci-fi movies, but I'm going to have to pick on it for a while.
It's
because
my number one movie for Jenny Goddard nude.
Okay.
It's maybe the only movie she appeared nude in, but that's what makes it number one.
I
have to go to the tote there on Logan's Run real quick to go off topic with you.
Okay.
Because Michael York takes off his shirt. She has to strip down bare ass naked.
Uh-huh.
What the hell? What, he can dry off with just his pants on and she can't?
Well, and no complaints there about that. Thank goodness they went that route.
I'm not complaining, mind you, but it just seemed a little, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Disjointed, a little unfair.
Exactly. Nothing kills the mood of seeing a wonderfully shaped naked woman than having a heaping dose of man ass to follow with that.
I'll grant you that. Perhaps they were thinking of the future there.
Yeah, but to pick on Logan's Run, I mean, it is a good movie. Again, it's one of Colleen's favorites. But, you know, if you think about it, 1976, we got Logan's Run, the logo being very disco-like, the artwork was the soundtrack, even the movie poster, everything was that airbrushed look, you know, from that era. The clothes, the hairstyles, the special effects. I mean, it's just a good story, but poorly executed. It's so dated, and that's 1976.
Yeah,
and
then you can feel the vibe of
the
production itself is designed in such a way to look so futury.
Exactly. But then you jump ahead 1 year and you get Star Wars, which is like, hold on. They just threw out everything we knew previously about science fiction movies. And that's what plays up – that's why it plays so well, is because it doesn't play like a science fiction flick. It really just plays as this very familiar story, something we can connect to as human beings, of the, you know, the typical – good versus evil story. But
In fact, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I was pretty well groomed for Star Wars by watching like Sinbad and some other Ray Harryhausen movies and the like, because there's a lot of that vibe there, because you've got that mythic element.
Exactly. You know, it's that typical David and Goliath type story that we can connect to. Here you have this unassuming farm boy with no particular fighting skills or even displays much in the way of bravery.
I'm gonna say he was assuming.
Yeah.
I would not go so far as to call Luke Skywalker unassuming, because he did a lot of assuming.
That's true.
He sat around all day and just assumed his ass right off. Little wonder Uncle Owen was pissed off at him all the time.
Tashi Station.
The boy assumes I'm going to let him go to Tashi Station. That sounded nothing like Uncle Owen deliberately, so I wasn't even trying there, kid.
But little by little, he grows and changes, and he takes that hero's journey of self-discovery, and he grows and matures into this confident warrior by the end. I mean, New Hope. He's an awkward teenager with no sense of direction.
Oh, absolutely. It's sort of like if Gilligan from Gilligan's Island managed to get off the island with the help of Philo Beddo from Any Which Way But Loose and Any Which Way You Can. Because, you know, you got the gorilla there, the orangutan there, Chewie doubling for Clyde.
Oh, yeah.
And then by the end, it's more like, you know, he's morphed into more like the like, I got nothing. I may be Maynard G. Krebs. He was a little more together by the end of the saga.
Because, you know, in Empire, he finds his
place. There aren't that many Bob Denver characters to fall back on. It's Dobie Gillis or the Far Out Space Nuts.
Oh, gosh. Far Out. Oh, my gosh. He had to go there. But, you know, in Empire, he finds his place in the universe, and he starts to mature to the point where by the end of Empire, he's willing to sacrifice his life to save his friends. Then Jedi, you know, he begins to master his emotions and skills to the point, you know, and by the end, he's fighting not only for his own soul, but also Anakin's soul. So,
and,
you know,
he also starts to take his schooling seriously.
Yeah.
So it means he's such a punk. Just in time to find out, oh, well, you're actually, we're done.
Yeah.
You just missed the graduation
that's
ceremony.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point.
That really, I guess, if we want to fall back on the previous episode a little bit, that did always kind of rub me the wrong way. It's like,
yeah,
I made a big deal about you leaving, but really, I love the graduation ceremony. I mean, in this case, it's just going to be you walking across the stage.
Yeah.
But yeah, still, it'll bring a tear to my little tiny green eye.
Yeah. Wait, you brought me all the way back to Dagobah for this?
Yeah.
Do you realize how expensive gas is nowadays?
Yeah, I mean, really, the fuel economy alone. The first time, Ben kind of told me to go. This time, I got shamed into returning. You could have mailed the certificate. You know, that's how this is done. You've been out of circulation for about 40 years, but here's... This is the way this works out there nowadays.
Oh, God.
I hope there's another Skywalker, because I'm quitting.
Oh, my gosh.
But, yeah, back to the real core issues here. One of the things that occurred to me today at lunch, because Star Wars is always on my mind.
Mm-hmm. You were always on my mind.
Especially at lunch, apparently. But one of the things that really occurred to me was you had your staple of the sci-fi realm, that is the laser or ray gun.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Up until Empire, you didn't have a single ray gun that looked like a ray gun.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like some solid, heavy-duty ordnance. It looked like stuff, if that thing quits shooting laser bolts, you could at least hit the guy with it.
Yeah, exactly.
You could club a guy with that stuff. You could crack his skull clean open.
Yeah.
And that, I think, you know, the fact that they took genuine machine guns and genuine rifles and pistols that were unique in design and then cobbled other pieces of other ordnance together.
Uh-huh.
To make something that looked real world, but at the same time was spacey.
Yeah.
That was science fiction-y. And then took that extra step and referred to them as blasters.
Yes, instead of ray guns.
Yeah. And, you know, suddenly you have vernacular. And you think, okay, that's just like a big double dip of cool. How do you top that? What is the hot fudge on top of that? And that's the lightsaber. Because all of a sudden you have taken mm-hmm. cool out into the stratosphere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you've taken the idea of the laser and made it stop.
Mm-hmm.
Made it hold its position.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it led you to thinking, what all can you do with that? And then eventually they did show you, you were right. You can mm-hmm. deflect laser blasts with it. Mm-hmm. You can, like, carve through walls with it and stuff.
Yeah.
It took a long time to get to that point where you got to see it visually on screen. But everything you ever thought was possible turned mm-hmm. out you were right.
Yeah, you can slice off Walrus Man's arm with no problem whatsoever.
Poor Walrus.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, and
that was his good arm. That was the thing.
That was his riding arm.
Yeah.
You know, he was a fine artist. He was a fine artist, and that was his arm that he created his art with. So there goes his trade.
Well, actually, you know, he had a really bad arm. It had a condition. And his doctors were like, you know, we're probably going to need to amputate.
Oh, God.
He didn't have the money for the operation. And he realized, you know, if I had held the gun left-handed, I could have saved so much money. Just saying.
That's his own fault, then.
Yeah, it really is. It's important if you've got a bad arm and you're facing an opponent, go ahead and see if you might be able to get rid of it in the process.
Yeah, there you go. But you bring up lightsabers, and to take it a step further, everything was such a cool design. Lightsabers all of a sudden became part of the pop culture, you know, visual pop culture encyclopedia that we have. I mean, how many people in the world don't know what a lightsaber is, or at least don't recognize it when they see it?
Oh, yeah. And who didn't have overnight the sort of ambient, you know, if you're in a foggy situation or anywhere where you get that kind of where you can capture the beam from a flashlight.
Uh-huh.
Didn't overnight just become one of the coolest things. It was already kind of a neat visual.
Yeah.
But now it was a lightsaber.
Yeah, exactly.
So that and, you know, just that Lucas's insistence, as he's often said, about having a lived-in look. And I think that a lot of productions captured that idea. A lot of them didn't. Mm-hmm. Other sci-fi and such. But beyond that lived-in look, I think one of the things that sold that lived-in look, and I've probably talked about it before, is the fact that it was a peopled universe.
Yeah.
that when you got out on the street, there was more than three guys out there.
And or three species.
Huh?
Or three species for that matter.
Yeah, exactly. And the really cool thing was the fact that there were droids.
Mm-hmm.
That there were background droids. You had your two droids you were concentrating on, but it was constantly put out there. They're not the only two out there.
Exactly.
These aren't the only true droids you're going to see. They're just the only two droids who matter to the story.
Yeah.
And apparently later you find out that some of them can be quite rude. Still not sure what Ichuta is, but I think you can probably draw your own conclusions there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. For a second, I thought you were invoking Jar Jar when he said, "How rude," in the Phantom Menace, but...
Now, that was one of the many recall...
Oh, on the Easter eggs that we talked about?
No, actually, this was something we forgot to talk about. So, like, in the much the same way that we would bring up the good when we were dredging out the bad, we're going to kind of do the opposite here. But that reminded me of something we didn't talk about, and that was the reuse of lines.
Uh-huh.
It's not my fault. How rude.
I have a bad feeling about this.
Yeah, it was just sort of like, oh, yeah, okay, I see what you're doing there. And it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's not that clever.
Yeah. But what, you know, where do you begin, as we said, with where does the saga... Part of the reason that it's so endearing and enduring is that there was so much going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even when it gets kind of cheesy, it's still forgivable.
Because it's so interesting. There's so many interesting things about the Star Wars universe in the movies, in the trilogy.
Well, also I think that there... A lot of people will cite Empire as like their favorite of the saga. And with good reason. You know, it is the number one if you ask around, if you polled people who gave you a genuine, serious answer and didn't just say episode one to be flippant.
Mm-hmm.
People will generally say that Empire Strikes Back was their favorite of the saga. I still will contend that Star Wars, a.k.a. A New Hope, is my favorite because...
Oh, me too.
It was in so many ways the purest because they were just, you know, so much of it was on the fly. They had no idea what they had their hands on, yet there are so many little subtle things that a lot of people are like, oh, yeah, I never really thought about like that. When Luke and Han are conveying Chewbacca to the cell block.
Yeah.
And they get on board the elevator. An officer comes up to take the elevator and is waved off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such a cool little reminder that this is a working space station chock full of people and you know, stormtroopers and officers and stuff. The guy walks up and he's like, he just wants to get, you know, where he needs to be on time.
Yeah.
He's probably on a performance review or something. And then these lowly stormtroopers are like, you know, pointing like, yeah, take a hike, buddy. I got a Wookiee. And, you know, later he's thinking it probably was for the best, but at the same time, he's probably thinking, why do we have a Wookiee?
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, that should have been questioned from the outset. The guy's like, where are you taking this thing? He's like, why do we have a Wookiee? That should have been your first question. You know, the Death Star wasn't that old. It hadn't been around that long. When did they have time to have a Wookiee?
Yeah.
But then, you know, I could probably write a Jedi justification to explain that away.
You know, you bring up that certain part of the movie, and of Star Wars A New Hope is my favorite also. But out of the movie itself...
You're copying me.
I know. I'm just trying to brown nose because, you know, you own this JC universe and all. But of the movie... itself, that middle act is my favorite, and it's something about the fact that the characters all get confined on the Death Star. They're confined there. They have to struggle to escape. They're going through corridors. They're trying to remain hidden. Years and years later, another one of my all-time favorite movies, Die Hard. And when I saw Die Hard, I remember watching and thinking, this kind of reminds me of the Death Star scene in A New Hope. And I remember selling that to somebody at school, and they're like, wait, you're comparing Die Hard to Star Wars? I was like, what, are you crazy? And I was like, no. I was like, he's confined in that – in Nakatomi – the Nakatomi building. He's hiding. He's trying to stay one step ahead, you know, to defeat the bad guys. And I thought, man, this is a lot like that middle part of Star Wars where they're – trying to stay one step ahead of the Empire.
You're just way ahead of your time. You were already formulating things to say on this show without ever knowing.
That's it. And of course, my friend can understand why I made that connection. But I always that's
a very good point, because I'm not steeped in Die Hard, but I have seen the first one and can see exactly where you're headed with that.
Yeah, so I remember thinking that's probably why I like the movie so much, because it kind of reminded me of my favorite part of A New Hope was, you know,
but
it also brings
up something that always struck me as really cool about that whole second act there, is that you have a series of separations and reunions.
Yeah.
Which is really cool, because, you know, Luke and Han break off of the main group, and Obi-Wan goes his own way, and the droids are here, and then
exactly
Luke and Han get Leia, and then Han and Chewie break away from Luke and Leia.
It's all back
little
and forth.
By little, all these disparate groups are brought together, albeit, you know, Obi-Wan's like 120 yards away getting himself martyred, but I just have to invoke Hardware Wars. Oh, you martyr.
Save that for our next episode. But that's what I love about that middle act of New Hope. You know, that the really relying on their wits to survive. Because seeing it for the first time, you didn't know if that was leading up to the climax. You didn't know if the climax was going to take place in that. The escape from the Death Star would be the climax, but, you know, lo and behold, we have the third act of the attack on the Death Star.
Exactly.
But,
and there's so many layers to the first one. And then, of course, you're moving into Empire Strikes Back, which is your hotly anticipated sequel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that I think is really cool is that all three of your initial trilogy films begin with Star Destroyers.
Mm-hmm.
The very first thing you get after your opening crawl, all three films, is a Star Destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
And there are going to be people like, wow, you know, I hadn't really thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do encounter people from time to time, like, wait a minute, what do you, oh, yeah, really, I'd never thought of it that way. You obviously think about this too much, and you're right. I honestly do. But, you know, the introduction, the exposition, I think, is one of the things that's really amazing.
Yes.
As you go into, you know, you're watching the little fake asteroids take flight, and then one crashes on the moon of the Hoth moon there, and then you get that great exposition scene with the Tauntaun running along.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sets the stage, and you're back to, oh wow, we're going to discover this world piecemeal again.
Exactly. They suck you right in again. They capture your imagination from the get-go within those first few minutes, and it's all a roller coaster ride from there.
That's right. It's like, what's this? It's a Tauntaun. Who cares? I don't know. Where is it? I have no idea what this is. And then later on, oh, it's a Tauntaun. You're going to mention it by name. It's like, you know, it goes back to Julie the Wookiee at this, or Julie the Monkey, rather. You know, where you're going to have to get all of this as you go along.
Uh-huh.
And you're either going to have to figure it out from hearing it the first time and misinterpret it, or, you know, read it later and realize how wrong you are.
But they don't have to explain everything to the audience. This was a good era in movie making, done right, where they didn't sit there and explain it. They didn't have to do a 20-minute origin to this, that, and the other to set up the movie that you're about to watch.
Well, you know, I think one of the things you can equate it to is you often see comparisons drawn with classic Westerns.
Yeah,
or classic,
exactly.
You know, period war films. I don't have to have the history of World War II or the Untamed West.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't need to have that spoon-fed to me to enjoy a war picture or a Western. I mean, granted, there's some foreknowledge. We've got some vague cultural idea of how both of these periods in history were for the most part, and it would, you know, be outrageous if you saw a Sherman tank in a, you know, a John Wayne movie that wasn't a World War II movie. Yes, that's mm-hmm. for those of you who, well, you know, John, well, no, I know that. I'm talking about Westerns. or, you know, if you saw a...
I love how you immediately have this argument to shoot down the would-be hecklers of the audience.
The nitpickers, yeah. But... You know, you don't have to have a lot of stuff explained to you.
Yeah.
I did have to explain to someone one time years ago that was not a bazooka that wasn't in active use in the field until much later in World War II, or much later in the 40s. That was a rocket-propelled grenade, which the Germans, in fact, did have at mm-hmm. that period in history.
Mm-hmm.
In Raiders of the Lost Ark. Mm-hmm. But that's a different story. But, you know, you don't have to have a lot of background fed to you. I mean, you know, none of us alive today going to the movies. If you go see Randolph Scott, you didn't have to be alive in the, you know, during the taming of the West to be able to appreciate what's going on. So you don't have to have a lot of stuff fed to you. And
that's
the
right.
way this took you away from Earth, it took you away from everything familiar, but treated it the same way as if there was at least some cultural familiarity.
Yes, there's a lot of familiarity in the movies.
And then all of a sudden you're become so immersed in this universe that pretty soon there is a cultural familiarity. And then you suddenly feel as at home there as you do in the Old West.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that was, you know, it was a presupposition of my level of intelligence even as a child. You know, that your audience is smart enough to just go in and here's the movie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I don't need a treatise on ancient Greece to go and see Jason and the Argonauts.
Thank goodness.
But, yeah, you know, there's a lot of filmmakers that seem to think that's necessary if they do sci-fi.
That's right.
I say just jump into the universe head first and go for it.
And yeah.
That's what makes it a classic.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly.
And then, you know, by the time you get to Jedi, you're starting to introduce an increasing number of force fails. But there are a lot of things that it did right as well. And, you know, one of the things, this was also one of the things that occurred to me earlier today, and it was lost to me till just this moment. When I was thinking of Ninum or Ninum or however you want to pronounce it.
Ninum.
Ninum. I've heard many a variation, so let's call the whole thing off. But one of the really amazing things that you go right back to New Hope, straight through the saga, at least through the first three anyway. I don't think, I'm racking my brain to think if there was a point where you see much, if any of this at all, in the prequels, which is unfortunate. You've got R2 and 3PO, which are the first example that you see of this happening. Then you get Han and Chewie. And then later on you get... what's his name? And Lando. Pronounce it how you will. Ninum mm-hmm. is how we pronounced it when I was a kid, so that's what we're going with.
Mm-hmm.
But you get these wonderful situations where you have characters who... do not verbalize in each other's language,
mm-hmm.
but understand each other's language.
That's a great point.
So it would be like if you did a movie where one guy was talking French and the other guy was talking English.
Uh-huh.
And the guy would say something in English and his partner would respond in French.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, I speak fluent French, but not to you. I'm not going to do it out loud. When I talk to you, I'm talking American.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a really cool conceptual thing, that you could have characters who do not verbalize each other's language form.
Uh-huh.
And you get that, you get it introduced with 3PO, but it's okay because he's a machine.
Mm-hmm.
And you find out later, you know, he can understand and speak all kinds of languages. Mm-hmm. But R2 is beeping and torting at him. And apparently the R2 units can all understand English or, you know, whatever. I'm going to call it English because that's the way it was. You know, I know it's supposed to be like Interlac or whatever. But, you know, the R2 unit can understand a spoken language, but isn't... nobody bothered to put a sound chip in to allow them to speak it.
Which always bugged me.
Yeah, like, come on, spend the extra $5.
Yeah, yeah. And it was all just to make R2 cuter, and yeah. It works, because he's so beloved with everybody, but we get why.
And but the thing is, there were some neat ways that they played with that whole concept, and that's what sold the concept. When 3PO and R2 are arguing... And 3PO says, you know, I don't think he likes you at all. And you hear this, no, mm-hmm. I don't like you either. And it's almost, you can infer that, do you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of stuff with Han and Chewie where you have that same sort of reaction where the mm-hmm. inference as well as the confirmation of that half of the it's almost like listening into half of a phone conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Or listening to... In a way, you kind of were eased into the Star Wars universe, oddly enough, by Charlie Brown.
Oh, that is brilliant. Oh, my gosh. That is groundbreaking.
In great
many
ways, it was the Han Chewie dynamic.
Oh, my gosh. A Rancor Pit exclusive, folks. You heard it here first.
That's right. So, yeah, if you want to know what Lucas's inspiration was, you need look no further than the, you know, Charlie Brown Christmas.
Oh, genius.
No, that one goes there. This one goes here. Or Alice the Goon, you know, from Popeye.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was a precedent set, and we just didn't realize that we'd already grown up with this. So I guess that's why it was so approachable.
We were already conditioned to think
that's right. We were ready when this arrived. So you get the same sort of thing when Nine Numb and Lando are piloting the Falcon, and he's like, I don't know what you just said, but I like it.
Oh, and you're forgetting one pair, which the aforementioned Walrus Man and the guy
that's true. They're hanging out.
Yeah, kind of reminds me of Tommy Lee Jones, but whatever. You know, whatever his name is.
Dr. Evazan is what he would become.
That's what it is. The pot face guy.
Yeah.
But those two, same instance. But what's
I didn't think about that. Yeah, because Walrus Man just.
Yeah. He doesn't like you.
He's constipated. Oh, no, that's not it.
But
what are you saying?
Yeah.
Can we let his droid come back in just for a minute? I got to find out what this guy's on about.
Yeah. But what's so funny is by the time we get to Jedi, then they do a 180 on us, and you get the Ewoks who nobody can understand them. So you have to rely on 3PO to actually, you know...
That's a really good point there, and I think it's because you have this species that nobody's bothered to encounter yet.
Exactly. They're so...
Nobody has a clue, one, what's going on there.
Yeah.
And even 3PO's kind of sketchy at best. Because he does point out it's a primitive dialect. So I imagine half
smacking
their heads saying, no, that's not exactly. It's kind of what I said, but it's not really.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you were telling us about using your powers and all, half of what you said was just gibberish. But when you started floating, I have to admit, my bowels moved all over the wood panel here. And even that got mistranslated.
Oh, gosh. That's a second poop reference between Bantha Poodoo and Ewok poop well, now. We're...
Ewok droppings, you know, it's just like... There's an international language right there for you. You know, when you drop a brick right on the...
Oh, gosh.
When you drop a brick in the treehouse, there's no mistaking what's going on.
Oh.
But yeah, that's an interesting point, because, you know, you finally encounter somebody that nobody can understand what they're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course,
but I guess getting back to... I'm sorry.
And I think Huttese must be one of those languages that nobody bothers with.
Oh, yeah.
Probably because the, you know, the Huts being the capitalists that they are, you know, they're always looking for an angle. You probably have to pay a royalty to even learn or speak Huttese.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I like that.
It's strictly controlled.
Oh, then this will really chap your hide is, I know you hate, well, I don't know if hate's too strong of a word, but, you know.
It may not be. You never know with me.
Well, it does lead to the dark side, so we need to be careful. So anyway, the Clone Wars TV series, in the first story arc, which was the theatrical release, Jabba the Hutt's cousin, I can't remember the character's name because he's not that memorable, obviously, speaks English. Not Huttese, which kind of bugged me. It really bugged me.
They couldn't pony up for subtitles. It's a freaking cartoon. Everything's a subtitle.
Well, Jabba spoke in his language.
Okay. Well, maybe he was like Oxford educated or something.
I guess. Maybe he was the
black. Oh, yes. Well, see, Meta sent me and felt that it was important that
maybe
cultured and learn the language and all.
Yeah, he was probably the black Hutt of the family, I guess.
Yeah. What's all these, you know, these guys, you know, you see these documentaries and stuff, and you'll see some professor from India or something, and he's got this just pristine British accent because he's studied in England for most of his life. Same sort of thing. It's this Hutt had probably been hanging around in Coruscant too long. Just even lost his Huttese accent.
I want to bring up one thing that's, to me, is a really strong aspect of the movie, which I think helps to connect it on a personal level to a lot of people. It's the Force, the spiritual aspect of the saga.
Oh, that's another good point, is as far as the strengths and what the saga brought to bear that makes it unique and hit.
Yeah. Well, you know, by using the Force as part of the story, it shows us the viewers and the players in the story that there is something bigger than ourselves, and that there is more going on than what we see around us. And obviously, ignoring the prequels, midichlorians and all, you know, I love how the Force isn't personified. It's described as that energy field that inhabits all living things, but.
Absolutely, that it is part and parcel to everything.
Yeah. But it is something that can be manipulated to be used for evil. So there is a strong life lesson in the movies that it's up to the individual to act responsible when using the Force, or in real life, you know, acting responsibly in your life.
Absolutely.
And how true these same principles when applied to our lives. And I think that's a great lesson to be learned from something that's just supposedly a modern day Western.
Well, exactly. And it also, what it did was something really unique that helped it not be like yet another thing that took it away from like, oh, this is all futuristic. Is that you combined that kind of, you know, sci-fi super science with mysticism. So it was sort of like, you know, having King Arthur and Buck Rogers all rolled into one, because you have this sort of the Force and you have those who can utilize it to their benefit. So you have that kind of mystical fantasy element mixed in with the sci-fi. And I mean, nobody was mixing science and sorcery like that until Thundar the Barbarian.
Oh, gosh.
Which granted, took obvious inspirations from Star Wars. And since we are giving equal time to the upsides after, mm-hmm. you know, doing what we could to bring up the downsides, mm-hmm. we should give some equal time to, or at least some time, to the prequels.
Mm-hmm.
So where did the prequels go right? And then this is the point where we'll add some chirping cricket sound effect.
Well, hold on. Before we get there, this will buy you some time to think of something.
or both of us.
One thing, in getting back to the spiritual part of the saga, episodes 46. This is one thing I always thought was pretty strong in the story, and I wanted to kind of voice this. Okay, so episodes 4-6. We see that the Force, faith, however you want to interpret it, is dead. It's irrelevant in this era. It's a foolish thing of the past. So Force, faith, call it what you will, has been replaced by this new god, the god of technology. So, you know, the Empire saying, we don't need this spiritual nonsense. We rely on our technology, you know. Their god, that what they rely on. So here comes Ben and Luke. And, you know, he's an old, you know, what appears to be a feeble man, but we know better. A timid, inexperienced farm boy. And they're armed with just nothing but the Force. So again, going back to earlier, much like the David and Goliath story, what does Luke use as the killing blow to the Death Star? It's his faith, you know, the Force. He turns off his computer. He relies on the Force to guide his actions. You know, so here we see his faith succeeding where others' use of technology has failed. So what could be more inspiring than Luke discovering something greater than himself and allowing himself to be an active, relevant part of that to accomplish the impossible?
Absolutely. And it, again, you know, is folding that kind of spirituality and mysticism and call uh-huh. it what you will into that sci-fi universe and meshing the two seamlessly.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's going back to what you said, that there's so many layers to the trilogy, the movies especially. That's why they're so successful.
Absolutely, and I think that unfortunately was something that was lost as you go into the prequels. Mm-hmm. Where they went right.
Okay.
There actually were some things that they did do right.
Okay.
One of the things, it brought back a lot of high concept stuff. And one of the things that I think escape a lot of people is the concept of Padme, Queen Amidala, is supposed to be like 16, and she's ruler of the whole freaking planet. To me, that is an incredibly high concept idea that gets lost in the storyline.
That's a good point.
And I think that's, you know, really cool that, okay, you establish that she's very young and she's queen of Naboo. Okay, great.
Yeah.
So your first instinct is that's a hereditary title that she has, you know, the former king or queen croaked. She's uh-huh. heir to the throne. So, you know, young monarchs are not outside of our realm of experience.
Yeah.
Except that when she goes to the Senate, she hauls off and mentions that her sovereignty is an elected position. She mm-hmm. is the elected queen.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Their definition of queen differs greatly from ours.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. that, you know, it just layers on more high concept. And I thought that was really cool because it suggested you have a culture where age isn't really the issue. It's what that person is bringing to bear.
That's a good point.
And, you know, to me that it implies so much about the culture of the Naboo that, you know, I looked upon it as sort of suggesting that, you know, if whatever it is you're going to go into, the Naboo are jumping right in the hairy middle of it at a very early age. There's no this dawdling around with crap.
Yeah.
Until you're old enough. And, you know, I think that that suggests that a lot of people, it almost to me suggested a culture where we get all this stuff out of the way when we're young so we can enjoy ourselves when we're older.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you want to go into politics, get all that out of the way while you're young and vibrant, and then retire at the age of 25. Spend the better part of your life kind of enjoying yourself. Because that is a leisure-rich culture, as you can tell.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, that was a really interesting conceptual stuff that gets lost in the shuffle.
That's a very strong aspect of the story that I've never considered before.
And again, those of you who mentioned earlier, you think about this far too much, you're right about me. Yes, I do. As if you needed this further confirmation of that fact. Some of the other things that were really cool, and I may have brought this up. There's a lot of I may have brought this up before because I also talk about this stuff incessantly.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember if it was just like out in the real world or on one of the myriad shows I've been on. By episode
Your life is basically one big podcast. So.
That's true. I just nonstop. Uh-huh. Ask Catherine. One of the things I thought was really cool in the incredibly cool opening sequence for episode 3 was when you had two big capital ships just firing broadsides into each other.
Yes, yes.
Just two big-ass capital ships going abreast and just firing, you know, guns ablazing into each other's...
Like, it was, to me, reminiscent of those old movies where you saw the pirate ships side by side firing those cannons.
Naval battle. And
yes.
To me, that struck me as sort of like that when the X-Wings and TIE fighters were fighting over the Death Star, that Lucas... specifically, you know, it's on record as he designed that to look like World War II dogfights.
Exactly.
And it's, to me, that the whole broadside attack struck me as sort of like, hey, let's pay a little tribute to like the pirate and naval battle movies.
Yes.
And that, to me, that was just really amazing, cool visual, because it did capture that same sort of spirit in a very subtle way that you're thinking about it later, like, wow, that is kind of like...
And that's what we needed more of. Instead of calling back to things we saw in the original trilogy, call back to other things we're familiar with that we haven't yet seen in the saga.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, there were a number of other interesting things, like the... to me, the Gungan force field, and I actually wrote about this in the Jedi Justification, the big Famba-based force field that they would generate, to me, that was the precursor to what the Rebels used on Hoth. Which apparently, like the one that the Gungans had, you can't fire on it, but you can walk through it. Which is why they sent the AT-AT. Because we learned you could drive through or walk through this thing, but from the outside, it is completely impenetrable by energy.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, to me, that there was a lot of what I looked at as precursor stuff from the design standpoints. There was, at least occasionally, this sort of attempt to, if you look at the second generation Jedi starfighters. Where their cockpit is very reminiscent of the TIE fighter.
Definitely.
And you kind of look at that as, you know, this is the stuff that the Republic was churning out at the time. Mm-hmm. It's not a far stretch as they went from being a Republic to being an Empire that the next generation of fighter craft would become what we know as the TIE fighter.
Yeah, it's those little things in design that kind of they kind of bridge the two trilogies together.
And speaking of the TIE fighter, that was another thing where you have this really cool progression where you have the TIE fighter and you bring the TIE fighter back, like, and then they give us the TIE bomber. And then they bring the TIE fighter back a third time, but then they say, or, and then of course you had Vader's TIE fighter, which was enough different that it's sort of like, you know, he gets the cool one.
Yeah.
And then
he gets the company car.
You kind of take that as being Vader's TIE fighter was sort of the prototype for the TIE interceptor.
Yeah.
Because somebody was thinking, you know, that's really great, guys, but if we threw that wing, that extra wing space forward and put guns on it, we'd get more for our money. And they're like, yeah, that's it. That's a good idea. Let's do that.
Yeah.
So they put a lot of those in production, obviously.
Yeah.
I also like the fact that in the original trilogy, you brought back that the same capital ship that was used as the blockade runner.
Mm-hmm.
When you have the Rebel fleet, they've got at least one more of those laying around.
Yeah.
They established that that's a very, you know, that's a design that's out there. That's a specific type of ship that's not unique.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the most unique spacecraft ever was the Millennium Falcon. You know, Lucas's flying hamburger was nothing short of brilliant because it's asymmetrical. In fact, it's very deliberately asymmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a very symmetrical design, and then you throw that cockpit on the side, and all of a sudden, it's just like, okay.
Yeah.
And what that says to me is, this is a spacecraft. It's going to spend most of its life in outer space, so it isn't lopsided. Because there's nothing pulling one side more than the other.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. You can fly bricks with as much precision as paper airplanes in space.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
As long as you're putting the same propulsion behind them, they'll move the same.
That's a good point.
And that, you know, a lot of the designs in Star Wars were the TIE fighters for crap. It's one of the most un-aerodynamic. It's well balanced, but it would, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's got about as much likelihood of flying as a cinder block. In a gravity situation. So that's one of the things I really liked also from the design standpoint is they're like the X-Wing fighter is, you know, reminiscent enough of actual aircraft, but you have so many other spacecraft that are like, that would not work outside of space.
Mm-hmm.
And then they haul off and let them work even in an atmospheric situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're flying TIE fighters around Cloud City, and they're you can obviously drive the Millennium Falcon or an X-Wing just pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is an upcoming, the next Jedi Justifications, I did the royal we there, I guess it's Queen Amidala rubbing off on me there. But I'll be actually tackling the issue of Star Wars spacecraft aerodynamics in an atmospheric situation.
Nice.
I have the answer. And like all Jedi justifications, it was there all the time.
That's why you're Jedi Cole, because you have the answers.
So anything else, anything that strikes you? Did I inspire anything for episodes 1 through 3 from you?
You know, I have no problem saying that I do enjoy the prequels. What has bugged me about fans is, and I've called people out on this before, is they sit there and they'll bash the prequels. And my response, one time it was happening at a comic shop, I responded to this guy. So I'm assuming you don't own Phantom Menace on DVD. He goes, well, yeah. I was like, why, if you hate it so much? He didn't have an answer.
I've got the answer for you here. It's a Jedi justification for that. It's called brand loyalty.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, I've fallen victim to that because I collected the Star Wars comic from Marvel.
Uh-huh.
From number 1 straight through 125.
Uh-huh.
And somewhere about midway, I probably, you know, flipped through them, but I never read like the last 40 or 50 issues.
Mm-hmm. Those were some of the best ones. You should try going back.
Yeah, maybe I should. But some of it was just god-awful. And I kept buying them out of brand loyalty.
Yeah. Okay.
And I, if they'd gone more than 125 issues, I'd probably still have been collecting it. But
yeah, yeah.
Thankfully, they put a bullet in its head.
Well,
let it die after they were starting to get into some really weird stuff.
You mean the little rabbits, the little telepathic rabbits?
Oh, yes.
The Hoojibs, I think they're called.
Hoojibs, yes. And then you had the Lashbees.
Which ones are those?
The Lashbees were the ones who were going around, and I think that, like, they would morph into giant, monstrous creatures.
Huh. I think I missed that one.
And then there was, like, some beret-wearing bug creature.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll quickly touch on the prequels. I do love the sense of wonder and excitement that we got with Episode 1, because it did capture a lot of that fun excitement that the original, that New Hope had. I will give it that. I was a little lost on Attack of the Clones. It kind of lost me, bored me a bit. But then they brought it back pretty strongly with Revenge of the Sith, with the emotions. And this is one thing I do want to bring up, is what's good about these movies is the emotional response that they give us. Me personally, I'd like to know first, Cole, what if you can think of one or two scenes of the saga that evokes a strong emotional response from you. I'll give my one or two, okay. But I want to hear yours first.
I see. You put me on the spot.
If you need time, I'll go first.
Yeah, you've already got yours.
Well, I can go first.
I think, though, that is a very good point, too. I think one of the ones that, you know, something that really strikes me anyway, is that kind of where you get this sort of growing relationship with, in the original trilogy, where you go from literally like Han being a hired hand. So you go from like a chartered trip, you know, business person, client relationship.
Yeah.
To, by Empire, you know, you've got Han, old buddy.
Yeah.
Where this sort of, you know, friendship was forged through survival, through this shared experience. And I think that was really kind of a cool thing, because you have these characters who have no reason to, you know, have ever crossed paths.
That's right.
And fate and circumstance bring them together to where by the end you've established this kind of family dynamic.
Exactly.
And I think that's a really cool progression that you get to see. And it's kind of a little very subtle continuity going on there.
That's right. That's right. He goes from being hired hand, like you said, to a family member.
Yeah, to a true friend. And
Yeah.
And, you know, and Leia goes from being like, oh, Miss High and Mighty, queen of the universe here, to, you know, sharing the common ground. He finds that she's actually not what he imagines someone who bears the title princess is like.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure in his experience, he's probably thinking more of a monarchy type of thing. And, you know, she might be a princess. That may be an elected office as well.
Yeah. She went from being space princess, as you like to say.
Space princess, yes.
Yeah. She went from space princess to the gal next door.
Yeah, she's just one of the guys at that point. You know.
Yeah, just one of the guys. Well, my emotional response that to the movies, there's two. One is in Jedi, where Luke very much almost loses control and kills Vader. That whole, where Vader's taunting him and he's trying to get at Luke by talking about Leia, that, you know, he'll turn her since he can't turn Luke, and then Luke just about loses it. And that whole scene, the music, the emotion, that all that, that intensity of that scene where Luke is just attacking Vader with all he's got. And for once, you actually finally see Vader having to backstep, having to retreat because, and I remember thinking that was so like, whoa, hold on a second. You know, Vader's actually, you know, he's, someone's getting the upper hand on him.
Yeah.
And then,
and Luke is just relentless in his attack.
Yes, yes, to the point where he could easily have struck him dead. And again, he catches himself. He catches himself before he crosses that line.
Into
dark territory. And to me, that spoke volumes to me on an emotional level. And leading up into Vader returning the favor, you know, reclaiming his soul, his, you know, Anakin coming to the forefront, Vader being pushed to the back, and, you know, saving Luke's life at the cost of his own. That, to me, that is a huge thing emotionally for me about the movie.
Absolutely.
Or the whole saga itself. It's that, it's just basically the story, and this didn't occur to me like a day or two back. The story of Anakin is just basically the story of the prodigal son. Mm-hmm. You know, we finally get to see the prodigal son return to the person he should be, and find his place in the world and, you know, do something good with himself, you know. The other part that gets me on an emotional level, it's very subtle, it's very, very simple, but it gets me every time, is in A New Hope, where Luke steps, you know, he feels very like lost, you know, Uncle Owen wants him to stay on, he wants to grow, he wants to find something that he can do in the universe that will make a difference.
Yeah, I told you he was assuming.
Yeah. So I love the scene where he steps out onto the dune and he's looking out at the Tatooine sunset and the music's playing. There's no dialogue. It's just music and visual.
Yeah, that is just all pure emotional resonance right there.
Yeah, yeah. That gets me every time because you can only imagine the heaviness, the things that are going through his mind at that moment. And that's one of the scenes that I think really connected me early on to Luke's character. You know, you find things in A New Hope and Empire and Jedi that connect you on a personal level, and I think that's where the strength of the movies comes from.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, that's another really good point, because you do, at least if you're me, you can't help but then going back after repeated viewings and you just kind of see the wheels turning there and you're thinking, you know, I wonder if Luke's thinking, you know, if only you were murdered by stormtroopers, then I wouldn't have to. And that's when he arrives and he's like, no, I was just, you know, who wouldn't think that? It feels terrible because, you know, that crossed his mind and it's obvious that's what happened.
Oh, wow.
And then by the time he gets back to the Jawas, he's got a little bit of a spring in his step. He's like, yeah, you know, I feel bad, but hey. I can go to Anchorhead anytime I damn well please. Now I can go to Tashi Station.
I could give me power converters as I want.
That's right. I'm going to go waste time with my friends. I'm going to take my new pal all the way out to Mos Eisley, even though that's milk
right.
run.
Hey, Cammy, Fixer, I'm going to meet you down at Tashi Station. Why don't you fire up the land speeder and meet me there.
Yeah, you get this sort of vibe with the whole Tashi Station thing where, you know, because some power converters, it's just sort of like the, was it in Fargo, McDonald's. You know what they're doing there? Not drinking milkshakes, I assure you that.
Oh, gosh.
It's like, you know, power converters is just sort of a...
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Not picking up power converters, I assure you that. Bunch of damn kids down at Tashi Station. But we are sadly drawing to a close. I knew this was one where we would, you know, the more we got our minds going on all good things, we touched on, and this one must come to an end as well, but we did touch on some things that I think a lot of people don't often think about. a lot of this, the primary strengths from the obvious to the subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, we even gave some nods to the episodes 1 through 3. And I think we're all, both going to be looking forward to the ups and the downs, the Force fails and the Force with us as we move into episodes 7 through 9 in the near future.
Definitely.
So we will be revisiting that once we get to find out where we're headed in the Star Wars saga.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, we're going to say farewell to that galaxy far, far away for a couple of weeks. We were a little late getting this one out, but we, we'll be back on schedule very shortly.
Mm-hmm.
Every other Friday, be sure and join us right here at the JCU for more of the Rancor Pit. Of course, special thanks to Eddie for helping me pull this one together in the nick of time.
Just in the nick of time. Yep. But yeah, until next time, Cole, do you want to take us out?
You know, the really big problem here is about a month ago, I finally hit upon a tagline and then promptly forgot it.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I have been racking my brain ever since, but I will remind you, you're coming at you through the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com.
Uh-huh.
You can, find myself and Eddie there involved in a great many things. Also, it's not too early to tell you about AllCon, where you can find me, Eddie, Catherine, Rick, Andy,
Bobby,
nearly everybody who's ever been on the JCU.
I think Colleen is actually going to make an appearance this year.
Oh, excellent. Colleen will be there. Drusilla, the whole gang will just be all over the place. Check out AllCon, ALL-CON.org, I believe it is. AllCon 2014, 10th anniversary of AllCon, my 10th anniversary of involvement with AllCon.
Mm-hmm.
I am, of course, the group captain of Games in Theory, which is the game show track for AllCon.
Or should we say the Jedi Master of Games in Theory?
I like group captain because it invokes Dr. Strangelove, and I always like to invoke as many things as I can.
Yeah, Cole's going to be riding that bomb all the way, that A-bomb all the way down.
That's right. I'm going to feel Woo-hoo! Come Monday when I finally start to recover from that. 4 days this coming
That's
year.
That's right,
Thursday
4 days.
Sunday. The Thursday of AllCon is free, so if you were doing it as kind of a tryout day, if you get a chance, come out and see that. There'll be a lot more coverage here at the JCU, probably a lot over at the USG at UnitedStatesOfGeekdom.com. If you're keen on this and other conventions in Texas, visit the Convention Awareness Project Texas at conventionawarenesstx.blogspot.com. And, of course, Eddie, where can we find your amazing work?
EddieMedina.com. I'm still working on getting the site revamped and somewhat presentable. But in the meantime, or anytime actually, Facebook, find me. You can search for, I think it's facebook.com/eddie.edmedart. Should be easy to find me on there.
Excellent. Until next time, we will.
I got one. Uh-oh, I got one.
Here we go.
I got one. Andy's not going to like this. Buy, collect, and read the Star Wars.
That one's for you, Andy. And with that, we will say farewell, and we will return to this galaxy far, far away in 2 weeks.